the way these Italian mechanics warmed it up was, all right, whap, 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 like 10 grand, it seemed like.
Somewhere in Italy, 1,000 old grandmothers dropped their pasta spoons and felt a disturbance in the force.
Right. He goes, what do you think? And I said, I am leaving this booth with this in my hand. And he goes, yes, you are. Go put it on the Ferrari. Tell me what you need. Tell me how to make it better. And we'll develop it together. And they went, okay, we need somebody to go to America and take care of the engine. We'll get Renzo because he knows everything about it.
He likes to sit. Why not?
Right.
Sit in America. Sit on a plane to America. Sit over there. Okay, hello and welcome to It's Not the Car, the only podcast that loves you as much as Gunther Steiner loves words that rhyme with duck. I'm Sam Smith. I'm a journalist and a club racer, and I once lost my phone underneath the passenger seat of a Ferrari 250 GTO at Thunder Hill, and that's not a joke, but it is a story we should probably tell on this show, and maybe at some point when we run out of other interesting stuff to say. That's assuming this is interesting to begin with. Ross, who are you? Go.
Ross Bentley, and I'm wearing a red shirt today just because.
No reason.
Because I like red cars, and I've driven red cars, and I coach people in red cars every now and then.
This might be relevant. Jeff, who are you? Go.
I'm Jeff Brown, and I brought a prop in for today's show.
Oh.
And I've had some experience with those cars as a race engineer, and some of the best times of my life.
He held up, for those of you not watching the video, which is probably most of you, he held up a very small model of a very red car that looks like a doorstop and has a very, 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 very tiny horse on it. Okay. And on that note, so the show changes formats about as often as my, as my 8-year-old daughter changes her favorite name for the imaginary unicorn that lives in her pillowcase. That means once a week. Today's format is our irregular excuse to talk about cars instead of people, but because this show is the show and we're who we are, it's probably going to be about people anyway. Now, sometimes that means a race car, sometimes that means a street car, sometimes it's something one of us has driven, but either way, it's usually a pretty rad story. Now, once upon a time, back in the heady days of, early January of this year, I decided we were going to call this format It Is the Car. But then somebody on social media, this very kind person who lives in New Jersey and tracks an old BMW and listens to the show, she pointed out in a comment that we should probably just call it It's Not Not the Car. And then, then I realized I was an idiot, and Not Not the Car is pretty much a great name for a podcast format. So today, with It's Not Not the Car, we're going to discuss something pretty special. It's a car both Ross and Jeff has raced. Jeff is an engineer. Ross is a driver. It is Italian. Now, I heard one of these things run once at Road America. It was just yowling away in the distance. I hadn't seen it yet. It was coming out of turn two, and I was way over in one of those fields that you can get lost in at that track. And I thought, well, clearly that's a Formula One car. I should walk over and see what it is. It was at a vintage race a couple of years ago, or maybe last year. And then it passed by, and it wasn't, but it had an F1 engine in it. And not just any F1 engine, but like the Formula One engine from what is arguably the Formula One team. And that's very cool. So the thing on this show is I take a slug of coffee and I give you a condensed kind of history and background of whatever we're going to talk about as quick as I can. And then we talk about it. So on that note, Jeff, Ross, you guys good if I do this?
Yes.
My favorite part of the show.
Oh, go. God. Go, oh, go, that's go. The pressure. The pressure. The engineer
can
likes
you handle it.
Can I handle it? No, of course not. Hi, I'm Sam. We make this show because we like it, but also because it keeps our young producer, Mike, off the street and away from a life of crime. If you want to help both of those things happen, you're in luck. We have this thing called Patreon. For a few bucks a month, you get to help support the show, but you also get some neat perks like monthly bonus episodes. The money we raise through Patreon helps keep this show on the air. If you like what you're getting here and want to help us keep doing it, that'd be great. If not, that's fine too. We like you anyway. You're here. We're glad. Join at patreon.com/notthecar. Back to the show. Okay, so it's the 1920s. We have an Italian man, a former race driver with big eyes and a nice smile. He's the team manager for Alfa Romeo's Grand Prix team. He has some success with this, a lot of success, in fact. His logo is borrowed from the personal crest of an old Italian flying ace in the First World War. His name has a lot of vowels. Wait a beat. A war comes and goes. After the war, this guy starts his own car company. Then a lot of things happen over the course of many years. First of all, first and most important thing is that company starts making Grand Prix cars and racing sports cars. Becomes known for 12-cylinder engines designed by incredible guys with names like Colombo and Lampredi. And if you say their names without a silly Italian accent, you are wrong. Those 12-cylinder things have great success. The Formula One cars and the sports cars. And the guy with the big eyes and the nice smile loses his son tragically to a terrible disease. And from then on, well, you know, he pretty much almost never smiles in public, and he hides those eyes behind sunglasses so no one can see his enormous feelings. He also kind of was a jerk because of those enormous feelings, but that's another story entirely. Now, just as important, in the early 1970s, the company, which has never had a lot of money, gets out of making sports cars and sports prototypes for racing purposes. Everyone is sad, but not entirely, because some of those sports racing cars were terrible. And anyway, you know, the Formula One team was taking up too much money. And if you're going to have the company from the sad dad in sunglasses do one thing, you really want it to be Formula One, you know, that's kind of the peak of the mountain. So that carries on until the mid-1990s roll around. Our friend, the sad dad, is sadly, sadly dead at that point. Sad dad dead, sad dead, sad dead. But the guy behind Momo, which is very closely tied to his company, the wheel company, steering wheels, wheels and accessories, is a big, rad-haired dude named Gimpero Moretti. He has a lot of sway within Ferrari. And at one point, he looks at the rule book for American sports car racing, and he gets it in his head that the company needs to go IMSA racing. They need to go sports car racing, in particular in North America, and moreover, that they can do this and be competitive. He presents this idea to Ferrari, the company, and Ferrari being Ferrari, well, if you believe the scuttlebutt, they're like, Momo, vaffanculo, which is Italian for please go climb up a rope. And initially, Moretti's like, well, no. And, you know, he's really good friends with a guy named Piero Ferrari, who is exactly who you think he is. He's the other son, the sad dad's illegitimate son. And Moretti also knows the president of Ferrari North America. And Piero at the time, he's managing Ferrari's special projects department, yada, yada, yada. One thing leads to another. And a new race car is eventually authorized by the president of Ferrari, a man named, I'm going to take a second to pronounce this because it's such a glorious name. It is Shakespearean. It is Luca Cordero de Montezemolo. Luca Cordero de Montezemolo. And his name is really fun to say. Take it from me. His name is really fun to say if you're in small town Italy and full of wine at some bar in the middle of nowhere and you want people to cheer. Ask me how I know, unless you say them in a bad accent. Then they look at you and they go, do you think that is an Italian accent? You are wrong. And then you realize you are bad at accents. Now, Luca, he basically turned around Ferrari, the company, in the 1990s. He made their cars far better, far less made of cheese. And many, many years before that, he had been one of Enzo's fair-haired lieutenants. Now, inside the company, this race car, this thing that Luca signed off on, that rad-haired Moretti was all, they called the thing Il Sogno Americano, or the American Dream. And it was not, as you'd expect, 2.5 kids in a picket fence in a house in New Jersey. What it was $900,000 worth of open cockpit prototype that was usually but not always painted red and that had an old Formula One V12 stuffed up its rumpus because that was basically all they could. This sounds crazy, but it's true. All they could afford. Fun fact, that engine was basically also the engine from the F50 supercar, as in F40, F50, the thing that followed after. But that's not important right now. Deliveries for this thing begin in February of 1994. Almost everyone in racing is surprised because Ferrari didn't do this sort of thing anymore. Three teams got one initially, Momo's team, and another one was Scandia Motorsports, run by a guy named Andy Evans. We were talking about before the show, and Ross has opinions, and I will not spoil them for you. Those cars ran in a lot of series. They won 47 races and 126 starts. They sounded like a Formula One car. They kind of looked, well, I mean, let's be honest, a little generic. I mean, good, but also look at WSC open cockpit prototype at the time. But they won 12 championships. Ross drove one. Jeff engineered one. The same car, in fact, at one point. It was chassis 003. And we think, we're not sure, but we think that Ross was the first person to drive one in North America, period. Mainly because they pulled it off the truck and they said, here, you, we have pasta times. So they called this thing the 333 SP for sports prototype. The number was from the traditional Ferrari approach of naming a car after a single cylinder's displacement in cubic centimeters, right? That's how you get cars like the 330, cars like the 250 GTO and short wheelbase, yada, yada, yada. Or alternately, depending on who you believe, 333 is half 666. So it's basically the devil. I don't know. I've never touched one. You guys have. What was it like?
So first of all, for me, I have always, the number three has always been, I'm not a big fan of luck. Like, I don't believe in luck, but it's been my lucky number. I love three. And through a lot of my racing career, when I had control over the number, I always picked three. So now here is my chance. I am going to drive chassis number three of the 333 SP. And I'm also not a guy that spends a lot of time thinking about, you know, memories of the past. To me, what's most important is what's happening tomorrow. But I can remember, so I got hired to drive for Scandia in 1994, did Daytona, did Sebring. We were in the world sports car, the WSC era of IMSA. And the team owner, Andy Evans, says, "We're going to buy this Ferrari." And I'm like, "Yeah, bring it on." And so we went to Atlanta Motor Speedway because the next race was at Road Atlanta. But we went to Atlanta Motor Speedway. And I can remember standing there, the Scandia truck with the regular IMSA stuff is all there. And I remember, I can picture this to this day, this truck showing up with this container. And it was a little bit like, you know, the clowns all jumping out of the car at the circus. All these Italians jumping out of this truck and then this other truck and this other van. And like there had to be eight Italians who could speak no English. And there was sort of this greeting of the Scandia mechanics and me and all of these, and we're all kind of grouping around and they're rolling this bright red brand new car out of this truck. And then they start putting it together and the American mechanics are somehow trying to communicate with the Italian mechanics and learn how things go together. And I'm watching this thing and then they fire it up and it's just, you know, it's the, you know, I'm thinking, fire the thing up, warm it up for a little bit. Well, the way these Italian mechanics warmed it up was, all right, whap, 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 like 10 grand, it seemed like.
Italy, do nothing slowly or quietly.
Yeah. It was so just like, and then they're like, get in the car, drive it around the paddock.
What? So wait a minute. So they sent over a bunch of Italians that didn't really speak any English. When the thing rolled off the truck, what did it look like? Like I read that the first few tubs were built by Ferrari and the rest were built by the Lara. And was it nicely put together? Was it pretty? Was it, I mean, what did you think when you looked at the details?
One of the prettiest things that I'd ever seen in my life. and it was the first, so I had driven Indy cars and the Indy cars in my era had gone from the aluminum monocoques to starting to use carbon fiber panels to the very last one I drove had, you know, was pretty much a carbon monocoque. But I got in this thing and this thing was all monocoque, all carbon. And prior to that, the prototype cars I'd driven were, and Jeff, you can talk to this about, mm-hmm. you know, you and I met a few months before that. Testing a Spice world sports car, open cockpit prototype car, and they all felt like kit cars.
Right? And why? What does that? What does that mean in top level prototype? If something feels that, was it a rigidity thing? Was it noise? Was it fit and finish? What was it?
Yes.
It was giant pilot.
You sat in there and you went, there's that aluminum panel there and that aluminum panel there. And they riveted them together and then they put some tubes on the back and then they stuffed this big old Chevy motor in there. And like, it was just all these pieces all put together. And it was, you know, classic British race car manufacturer type building of a race car. And I sit in this Ferrari the first time and going, whoa, this is like, it's all one car. It felt to me like it was sculpted out of one block, mm-hmm. and it was sculpted out of this carbon and this beautiful V12 motor back there. and Jeff, I mean, the first time you saw one, didn't you kind of go some of the same, like, just, this is not a kit car.
Yeah. It was for sure. It was the first non aluminum honeycomb rivet and glue car that I have, you know, that I got to run. And it looked like it was built for a singular purpose, where the other ones you could identify on the other prototypes of that era. You could identify every part, and it could be on another car or someplace else. You go, yeah, I've seen that. You've all seen all of these parts, suspension, wishbones, uprights. You looked at the Ferrari and you went, yep, I have never seen that front spindle before. I've never seen a pushrod like that before. I've never seen a rocker built like that before. And some of it was, you know, it was Dallara, who Tony Southgate and Dallara had a lot to do with that car, and commissioned by Ferrari. I don't know exactly the details, but when you needed a part for the suspension or for the chassis, you got those from Dallara. And it kind of showed you, you know, it was their kind of first presentation to America, for sure, of what Dallara could do as a race car manufacturer. And when you had Lola and Reynard at the time that were like the key guys, and Spice in sports cars. And so, yeah, it was beautiful.
And that's relevant too, right? Because, like, for those who don't know, you know, Dallara, you know, Dallara started off as a fairly small company, but they end up being one of the world's largest series manufacturers of racing cars. Like, it's fair to say that they've probably, outside of Porsche, they've probably built more turnkey racing tubs than just about anybody else on the planet. Yep. And Southgate, you know, you mentioned him. He was tied to the Jaguar XJRs that won Le Mans. He was tied to the Ford RS200 Group B cars. He had done work for like BRM and Shadow and Arrows. And I want to say that he was still involved, like the Bentley Le Mans program as late as like 20 years ago. But just massive, massive names. And it's interesting for a program like the 333 that came out the way it did, that so much of the rest of that car looked the way it did and felt that way. So when you drove it around the parking lot, what happened then? What was next?
Well, I guess while I'm waiting, just to kind of put things into perspective, while I'm waiting, as they're piecing this together, there was a couple of people there at Atlanta Motor Speedway, and they had a Legends car. You know those Legend cars, those little tiny cars?
Yeah, they look like 1930s Fords or Chevys that are, yes, but they're tube frame and made for circle track stuff.
And they had one of those, and they're like firing up and running around in the paddock area. And they said, "Do you want to drive it?" I'm like, "Well, of course I'm going to drive it." So I hopped in this Legend car, and I'm blasting around, and I've kind of got, they set up like a few cones, and I'm just like blasting around this thing. Well, then I hop out of that, and oh, your Ferrari's ready. So I went from this Legends car into the 333, wow, and fired up, and we blast around, and it was really just a shakedown just to make sure that everything worked. And, you know, I'm sure they had pieced it all together and done some kind of a test in Italy before they shipped it. But then they, you know, had to put it all together, and they pieced it together. We spent half a day kind of just making sure all the systems worked and everything was ready. And then it got moved into the Scandia trailer and moved up the road to Road Atlanta, where I was going to race it this upcoming weekend. I believe there was like a 2-week period in there, because we were the very first ones to get one. And then the other teams started getting theirs. And when we showed up to Road Atlanta, I think there were five of them, I think. And, you know, different teams that had them, Euro Motorsport and, Jeff, I can't remember who the rest of the other teams were that.
Yeah.
First
I remember
got
the Euro Motorsport one that was, Antonio Ferrari.
Yes.
Apparently no relation to the real Ferrari family.
Although, the real Ferrari made it very clear that there was no relation, but
exactly.
I think Antonio kind of liked to, maybe I could be.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Moretti didn't get his first. I would have thought he would have got his first.
He did not. Because I don't know why. Maybe because of Andy Evans and his checkbook. I don't know.
Oh, maybe. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
Quick story that's not totally related to the car, but kind of related to the car, was that weekend at Road Atlanta, on Saturday night, Ferrari did a big event at the resort on Lake Lanier. I can't remember the name of the resort there. And they did a big dinner kind of thanking these teams for taking on the 333 project. And Sam, you're going to have to help me pronounce the name of the president of Ferrari North America at the time. Do you know that name?
Wait, no, actually. Do you remember who it was?
I can't remember his name, but and even if I could remember it, I couldn't pronounce it. all I know is you know, it's kind of one of those cool things is at the dinner, they presented each of the drivers that were going to drive the 333 that weekend with a solid gold prancing horse. It's, you know, no more than half an inch tall, but it's like a pin that you would put on, you know, a jacket or whatever, right? Wow. And it's a solid gold thing. And they made a big deal that every year they gave a pin to their Formula One drivers. And this is the first time they'd given them to anybody other than Formula One drivers. And I have one of those.
That's awesome.
I have, I found a nice little painting of the 333 that I drove that weekend. I had it stuck in the, you know, it's on the frame of this photo that I have hanging on my wall. And it's kind of one of those, you know, again, I'm not a big memory kind of person. I throw away old trophies. I don't like that kind of stuff, but that's a trophy that is really cool because I was one of the very first ones to ever drive that car.
That's so cool. It's worth unpacking that for a second, right? Because, you know, everybody, you know, and this was in the news recently, not recently, but in the past, you know, 6 months or so, because Lewis Hamilton's getting toward the twilight of his career. And, you know, he ended up taking a seat at Ferrari. And one of the reasons he gave and one of the reasons all the analysts gave, everybody looked at it, was like, well, you know, of course, it's every F1 driver's dream at some point. Everybody wants to tick it off a list before they do it. And there's this laundry list of drivers who made their way through the sport and in either a less than ideal time or, you know, they just did one race or there was something attached. There was some big weight attached to driving for that team. And if you go back, it goes all the way back to almost the beginnings of the place and the mystique that hung around it. And the fact that whatever it was, you know, and they know, right? And they clearly know. I've been to Fiorano. I've been to the farmhouse that holds Enzo's office. You know, it's mummified, the old telephone and the desk and the lamp and the newspapers. Everything is exactly as it was the day he died. They know the mystique is real. And you can know all that and think, well, you know, I'm going to be immune from it. And then it doesn't matter because the day it comes that you drive one or you see one, or somebody rolls a 333 off a truck and you're in it and you get the pin why did that mean something to you? Why? What was it?
I ran afoul of that mystique.
engineer. What does that even mean? That's amazing. I mean, this is also, it's also worth noting that, like, famously, anybody who's been inside half of their cars goes, well, half of their cars are crap. I mean, they're nice parts, but so much of it is crap. So, like, please tell me that you had one of those moments, Jeff, as an engineer where you Jeffed it. Like, what does it mean?
I did. And I feel, I learned quickly. It was a major gaffe. I started running the Ferrari. This was Daytona. So I'm guessing it was probably 95 at Daytona, and the car, I think it was its first Daytona, the 333's first Daytona. So we show up, I'm with Team Scandia, and we show up and we unload the car, and it's Daytona 24 hours. So, you know, there's a lot of, buzz and media, and there's a Ferrari's coming back to Daytona. It hasn't run there for whenever since the '70s, and this is going to be cool. And so we're in the garage area and we're, me and the mechanics are doing the work, but I'm doing the setup stuff and working with my drivers to try to make it better. And somebody came up, I think it was a media guy, and they said, wow, you know, you're the engineer in this car. This must be amazing. You get to run this Ferrari and, you know, the Ferrari and the Tifosi and all of that stuff. He goes, well, tell me about the car. You know, how is it? And I had come out of the trailer with debriefing my drivers, and I was just going to talk to the mechanics about what we needed to change. So I was total engineer mode, and I was like, well, I don't know, you know, seems a little slow in a straight line. I think it's way too draggy compared to the other cars. And it turned 5, 6 and turned 3, the thing understeers like crazy. I think the splitter is way too short. We need more splitter. Maybe I can take some wing out of it. I don't know. I think it's, man, damping in the bus stop curbs is just the damping's way off. I said, ah, we got a lot of work. It's not exactly what I, you know, we're not there yet. And he had this look on his face like I had just run down this beautiful machine. And how could you say this? And, you know, like the most disparaging comments you could ever hear. And I got the and he said, really? But it's a Ferrari. And I said, yeah, got the same problems every other race car has.
And somewhere in Italy, 1,000 old grandmothers dropped their pasta spoons and felt a disturbance in the force.
Right. And I didn't really realize that he went away. And then later it came up and I was like, oh yeah. Oof. All right. I get it. They explained the whole thing to me and I was like, okay, right. You can't say that, you know, no, it's a Ferrari. It's amazing. It's really great. You know? And it didn't take but 3 or 4 races to actually, I didn't have to fake it anymore. I was like, wow, this is a Ferrari. This is pretty darn cool. And yeah, there's a lot to this. And so I'm as big a fan of the mystique of it now as anybody, but early on, I didn't get it.
Yeah. And Sam, I think, you know, I look at cars as they're tools, you know, am I going to use a ratchet or an open end wrench? Like it's just it's just a tool. But yes, wearing red driving suit, getting a gold prancing horse, meeting the president of Ferrari North America, that whole thing, you can't help but get caught up in that mystique a little bit. And yeah, I'm going to say it was a very important, special moment in my racing career. And unfortunately, that part of it was a very short moment. It lasted one race at that point, and it took me another 6 years before I got back into a 333 again.
Well, wait, what happened? So you drove it, which race? And so this was 94 then?
94, Road Atlanta, IMSA race. And the time we were, it feels like to me, it was like a 2-hour and 45-minute race and 2 drivers. It was myself and Andy Evans, the team owner. And I have no idea where we qualified. You know, all the Ferraris were kind of near the front. And I think at the time it was, trying to think if Dyson was running at that in 94 or not, but in a non-Ferrari. I can't remember who we were actually competing against in non-Ferraris at that year. But
it would have been Mark III Rileys, I think. Right.
Yeah, I think they came out that year, but I'm not sure if they were ready for Road Atlanta. I don't. Yeah. You know. Like
regardless,
I said,
so you ran it, and you got how much of that race, and then you were done for years. What happened?
So I came in with 35 minutes left in the race and handed the car off to my co-driver, the team owner, and in the lead, and. In the last 35 minutes, we went from the lead to sixth, something like that. And kind of standing in pit lane going, oh, darn. Maybe that wasn't the word I used, but oh, darn. You know, we're not going to win this first race. And I'm standing there at the pit wall when he came in and he proceeded to stand up in the cockpit and yell at me for using up the car and making him look bad. And, you know, he had a bit of a reputation for how he treated people. And I had seen a fair bit of that up to that point. And at that point I went, you know, I don't know if this is the dumbest thing I've ever done in my career or the smartest thing I've ever done in my career. Here I am. I got a chance to drive a $1 million Ferrari. I'm getting paid. You know, the year before I couldn't afford to put food on the table. And now I was getting paid to drive a Ferrari, but I kind of went, I can't work in these conditions. I can't not be around somebody who worked with people the way he did. And I, you know, the next day I informed him that I'm not driving for you anymore.
I don't blame you. Must have been a strange feeling. Must have, what, yeah. Before, we'll go back a sec. What, What was a car like that like? Because I mean, the one of the interesting things about the about race cars, and especially about professional level race cars, is that some of them are easy, some of them are fatiguing, some of them are uncomfortable, some of them are, you know, you could, people have told me they're Formula One cars. You can sit just shy of the limit in for 30 days out of the month, and it, you know, you won't, they don't wear you out. Where did that car sit on the spectrum, right? Because you think Ferrari, you think histrionics, you think grand drama and operatic noise all the time. And, you know, it couldn't have been if you enjoyed it, right?
Oh, it was mind-boggling how much fun it was. And, you know, the previous seasons of racing, I'd been driving a less than competitive Indy car. And Indy cars, I don't care, good, bad, ugly, whatever, they hurt your body. To this day, you can talk to an IndyCar driver and they're like, their bodies are in pain all the time. I don't care. You know, you could train every day, no matter, nonstop, and IndyCars hurt your body and they're a lot of work. When my first sports car race in a prototype car was Daytona in January, like a few months earlier, 3 months earlier. And I got into these prototype cars going, man, I could drive one with two hands tied behind my back. These are so easy. And, you know, this is a bit of a tangent, but the very first practice session at Daytona in the very first IMSA race I ever did in a prototype car, I remember sitting there for the very first practice session and I'm sitting in the car and the engine's running and we're waiting for the green flag and it's like green. And I'm like, burn out and blast down pit lane because that's what you did in Indy cars. And I get out there and I look in the mirror and it's like, there's nobody here. And I kind of went, a lot of these sports car drivers at that time would take their time leaving pit lane, kind of warm things up. And I'm like, wow, sports car racing is different. So for me, driving that car was, it was easy. It was beautiful. It was, the sound was great. I was in the lead. I was, you know, after driving uncompetitive cars for a bunch of years, this is like, what nice. Could be better? Yeah. And it's in a Ferrari.
It's interesting too. The most of my Ferrari experience has been in road cars, right? You know, I mentioned earlier, I have a little bit of time in and around some of the sports racing cars they made in the '60s. But for the most part, like up until when I said earlier that De Montezemolo changed how the company worked, you know, he genuinely did. They're, for the longest time, they were known for wonderfully engineered drivetrains that were not unburstable, but very, very durable and, you know, had big, seamless, long power bands and weren't peaky and made these operatic noises. And then the rest of the car was not bad, but by connection, you know, you look at some of the switchgear on, you know, 60s, 250s or 330s, you know, there's better stuff on General Motors cars of the period. And so much of what they did for so long, you know, was kind of compromised around the fact that they knew they could get away with it. De Montezemolo shifted that. How that motor in particular, what did it feel like? What did it sound like? How can you, I mean, can you describe it? Can you pull it apart?
Well, you want me to make engine noises here?
Like, yes, yes, do it.
No, because yes. I'm really bad at those.
go on YouTube. Anybody
yeah,
who wants YouTube, to listen to that thing, go on YouTube and.
Yeah.
Man, oh man, it brings back big memories.
It was everything that anybody who knows anything about cars can imagine about the sound of a Ferrari at, Jeff, do you remember what RPMs we were running? Like 12,000?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And then as the rules came to try to make it, you know, the Ferrari became fairly dominant and then they had to start restricting and the rev limit dropped. But when we first were going, man, I got to say, somebody will look this up and say I'm completely wrong, but I'm not so sure it wasn't closer to 13, but it was in the 12s, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, you know, it felt fantastic. This very nice sequential gearbox. It was, I'm going to say it was one of the first cars that I drove that it was like, there's no weak point in it. The brakes worked. The gearbox worked. The engine worked. Yep. You know, it stuck. It, you know, it did everything. And, you know, one of those moments that from that weekend is, you know, first of all, that was the last year that Road Atlanta had the downhill dip coming up to the bridge at the end of the back straight.
Before they put in the chicane.
A and B.
Where now it's turned into A, B, you know. So it was, you know, I think we came down the back straight and we went, dropped down a gear and kind of brushed the brakes and then stood on the throttle and popped up over the top of the hill underneath the bridge. And like, it was mega through there. And it was, just an incredible all round experience of there was nothing in the car that you went, oh, that's a weakness. Now, again, this is the first time out of the box. So it was not well tuned. And then, like I said, I kind of walked away from it and I kind of go, Jeff, you then were the magician that made the 333 what it was. I mean, you won more races with that car than maybe anybody.
I mean, we won a lot of races and it was that whole development of that car. Like you said, Ross, it started out as a fantastic car and really put Dallara on it was a Ferrari commissioned by Ferrari with Ferrari input and things like that and the Ferrari engine and gearbox, but it was kind of built by Dallara and you can see that trends of cars like that where it doesn't have a weirdness that you have to design or you have to set up around. But because we weren't the only one with them, anybody who had $1 million could buy one.
All of us, really. I mean, hell, I thought about buying $1 million
in 93, which is, right. I don't know, you know. There were millionaires buying them then. Now it takes billionaires to buy those kind of things. But anyway, so we were trying to develop this car better than the other guys who had a Ferrari, better than the Momo guys with Kevin Doran, who ran that team, who was a brilliant guy, and better than all the others. So we started to look how we could make it better and better. And one of the big things that came in was that this was back in the, and I don't know if somebody again will look this up, but it had a flat bottom, no tunnels. And that was required by the rules, and because they were trying to take some downforce away and things like that in that era of sports car racing. So it had a flat bottom, which meant the floor was flat from the splitter all the way to the diffuser at the end, which really wasn't a diffuser. It was just flat. So the car had this problem of porpoising, which basically the air would flow under the car, make downforce. The car would suck to the ground, get too close to the ground, shut the air off under the car. And then it wouldn't make downforce and it would pop up. Formula One cars have had it a couple of years ago. And so we had to run the cars higher than we wanted to prevent that. Well, then in the infield, when you were going slow, they were way too high to make good downforce. So we came up with a way of, which is common now in all single seaters and sports prototypes, of using what's called a third spring. And it allows you to run the car much lower on the straightaways without getting it too low. And then you can benefit from that extra low ride height in the corners. And we developed that. I built one myself in my shop and we took it to the track and it really worked well, but it wasn't manufactured very good. I made it on my lathe and my mill in my shop.
Hold on for a second. So when you say you developed a third spring, right? Describe what that is. You know, the picture that you sent, it looked like, you know, and an inerter looks very similar, but it looked like just an extra shock sitting on the car. What was the process of Jeff realizes there's a problem? Jeff realizes there's a problem that can be fixed by a part. Jeff goes and builds and develops a part. That's not that common anymore.
No, it was because, wow. I just had this flashback how cool it was not to have a homologated car. You know, it's like,
whoa. That was BOP. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. There was not. I mean, yeah. Man. Yeah.
Context.
I was going to
context. I just those thought who don't, about oh, sorry.
What you, what you said, Sam, I'm like, yeah, that could never happen today.
Yeah. Right. For those who don't know, most modern race cars, every single part on them is homologated. It has to fit a rule book, has to be identical. You can't modify it. You can't screw with it. And it's in the interest of basically what Ross said, BOP, balance of performance, and making the fields even as possible. But you did this, and?
Well, it was pretty simple. I knew I needed to run the car lower because it was faster lower. But when you ran it lower, when you ran it low at the ride height that you wanted for the corners, for the fast corners, it would hit the ground on the straightaways. So you couldn't do that. So you had to raise the car up so you didn't grind it on the ground. And there was, so you had two shock absorbers, and I looked at it and said, well, we have two shock absorbers on each axle, right? On the front, let's just take the front, for instance, two shock absorbers. As you go down the straightaway, the aerodynamics push down, the shock absorbers squish and they get shorter, and it pumps the fluid out of the shock absorber into the reservoir. What about if we, and I thought, what about if we take the reservoirs and take those off and put another, a single reservoir, connect the two shocks, put a single reservoir with a spring in the back of it and a piston. So as the fluid comes out of the shocks, because it's being pushed down, it pushes against this single piston and compresses a spring. And we could adjust that spring rate for how stiff we want the vertical stiffness of the car to be. But yet the car still works normally in roll. The shocks go normal in roll. And so I built a really crude version of that in my shop, put it on the car. We messed around with it. And it turned out we could run the car, if I remember, it was like 6 or 7 millimeters lower, where
it's a big deal.
2 millimeters is a huge deal. Yeah. 1 millimeter you will scrape for all day long. And we could run it 7 millimeters lower and not hit the ground on the straightaways and not have to run such stiff springs that we had no grip in the corners. So we built that. We ran that a couple races. Then the PRI show, which is a big racing trade show that comes around every year, was toward the end of that year. And I was talking with a guy by the name of Jeff Ryan, who ran Penske Shocks, the most brilliant damper designer, engineer I've ever known. The guy is off the charts. And I was talking with him at the Penske booth, and he says to me, he says, hey, I got something to show you. And I said, okay, cool. And he says, come back here. And we go in his little meeting room, you know, how they have those booths where you can make deals to buy whatever. So he takes me back there where nobody was. And he says, he hands me this thing, and it's a third spring like I had built, but it's beautiful. It's machined properly. It's not made by some guy in his shop in Texas. You know, it's actually done the right way. It has little adjusters on it. It has the proper fittings. It has needle valves and stuff. And I'm like, wow. And I just held it in my hand. I didn't want to comment because I was like, well, this is, yeah, I've did this before, like 4 months ago, 5 months ago. I didn't want to say anything. And he could see the look on my face, Jeff Ryan. He goes, just hold on. He opens up his briefcase and he pulls out this stack of pictures. He hands it to me.
Wait, what?
And it's like 20 shots of my third spring on the Ferrari. And I said, oh, so you know about that. And he goes, yeah, here's what I did. And I said, wow, that's so much amazing. Better than me. This is fantastic. Okay. So we're now talking openly here.
Yeah.
He says, yeah. He goes, what do you think? And I said, I am leaving this booth with this in my hand. And he goes, yes, you are. Go put it on the Ferrari. Tell me what you need. Tell me how to make it better. And we'll develop it together. And so I snagged that thing, and then we got to develop it for quite a long time.
That's so
Jeff,
cool.
How much do you get in licensing royalty fees every year from that now? Does Roger like send you a check every year?
Yes.
Zero.
Yes.
What? Zero. Yeah. Because what happened was, like a lot of things, it ended up on that car for a while. And within, I don't know, it's banned in most places now. And then IndyCar came out with mechanical third springs, which are on every IndyCar. And so the hydraulic third spring kind of got I don't know. Not many people use it anymore, but it's still the, I think Jeff Ryan would even to this day tell you that there's benefits of a hydraulic third spring over a mechanical third spring.
I was just going to ask.
He understood how it worked, especially in roll, much better than I did. And, you know, anyway, it's something that kind of unlocked the potential and got around the flat floor on sports prototypes of those days. And the Ferrari was just, I think after a year, when Penske started selling them, everybody on a Ferrari had one. You had to be competitive with it.
How common was it in that era to get something? I mean, even from a company like Dallara, right? I know you said it put them on the map, basically. But how common was it in that era to have a car roll off the truck and be not? I mean, if no race car is ever fresh off the truck, brand new, runnable. But how common was it to have something be that sorted, or at least as sorted as that one was?
Yeah, I don't.
Did you see it a lot?
For me, it was not common.
And can I, Jeff, you mentioned earlier on the Riley and Scott Mark III.
Yep.
And now, like, as we're talking, I'm kind of like, yeah, I left Scandia in April, and then it was, I think, August that I got hired by a team that had bought one of the very first Riley and Scott. So they came out, and the Riley and Scott, I just to kind of put this all into perspective a little bit, you know, Riley and Scott was designed by Bob Riley, and Mark Scott was his partner in that. They built, I'm going to say, almost like the ultimate opposite Ferrari.
What is an opposite Ferrari besides, I don't know, an inside out tomato? What does that look like?
Like the that kit car thing that I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
It was like that kit car perfected. And Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, the Ferrari was meant to be, it was meant to be more aero, like slippery. Bob Riley's approach was build the thing with as much downforce as you can possibly make and just drive the thing into the track. So there were very two different philosophies, right, Jeff? And that became that, I'm going to say mid to late 90s was what made sports car racing in IMSA really cool, because you had this Ferrari and you had this Riley and Scott. Very two different race cars, and I got the chance to drive both of those ones, and it made some great racing.
Oh yeah, I mean, because there were times with the Ferrari, I was almost always wanted more downforce, and I'm pretty sure the Riley and Scott guys always wanted, not always, but oftentimes wanted less drag, and so they raced differently, which meant that at Lime Rock, you wanted one car, and at Daytona, you wanted a different one.
And Jeff, if you remember, actually, now at the end of 95, I think it was, we went to that street course in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And this was funny because I remember doing a track walk, and the slabs of concrete that made up the streets in New Orleans,
yep,
they were like Thursday afternoon, they were going around and they were pumping some kind of fluid underneath the slabs to try, yep, to get them, because there were places where the slabs were 3-4 inches not matching, and they were expecting race cars to drive over that, so they're trying to bring them up. And all I remember is you know, me and James Weaver in two Riley and Scotts, like, we just took off on the field, and the Ferraris were like struggling back there because that was not a track for them. But yep, New Orleans street course downforce was king there. So right. Yeah, it made some good stuff. So yeah,
I had some college class on geology, and somehow the prehistoric motions and moves and plates and stuff that made up whatever ended up being the, you know, the stuff underneath Louisiana and why Louisiana behaves the way it does and why all the stuff in New Orleans behaves the way it does came up in this class. And somebody asked why all that worked the way it didn't. And the professor was like, well, you know, everything in Louisiana is about fluid management, and especially everything in New Orleans. And there was a pause, and this kid looked up and he's like, what about Mardi Gras? And the guy was like, especially Mardi Gras.
It was just fluid, like, management.
Just fluid management. Everything's about liquids. Sometimes exactly. You don't want them there. So yeah. You guys touched on something earlier. So the notion that in that period, and this, you know, this goes back all the way to the beginning of motorsport, and I know it's lessened as time has gone on, but you alluded to the fact and that both of those cars, the Riley and Scott and the Ferrari, drove differently and felt differently and needed things different from the driver, the different techniques, right? But modern, I've had a number of people tell me that's just diminished over the past 20 years. How often now across various manufacturers in prototypes, right? In P2 cars. I mean, how often does one manufacturer spit something out to a set of rules and it feels like a ham sandwich, and the other manufacturer spits something out and it feels like a cheese sandwich, and you could blindfolded drive them and know the difference? I mean, or is it just they're all the same, and well, this car makes a little more downforce and fast stuff, and it's a little less stable on the brakes, so do this, but they're the same. What does it look like now?
I think it doesn't happen that much anymore for a couple reasons. One of the reasons is we've gotten better, so much better at understanding what the right answer is, because there is one right answer. If you're going to take the new GTP IMSA cars, there's one right answer, right? For downforce, drag, efficiency, things like that in a category. It's why all Formula One cars, and I say they look the same. Yeah, to the trained eye, maybe one guy has three elements on his front wing and one guy has four and they're a little smaller, but I mean, they kind of all look the same. The GTP cars, to their credit, they opened it up a little bit more to allow a little bit more freedom, but still, they kind of all look the same. A Riley and Scott Mark III and a Ferrari 333, you know, the proverbial grandmother could tell the difference, but you'd have to look hard to tell the difference between a Cadillac GTP car and a Porsche GTP car.
And driving the two? Because, yeah, I went through that period of drove the 333, then I drove the Riley and Scott, and then I got back into a 333 a few years later. And the Ferrari was like you were doing something with some metal, and you're using a fine file to file it smooth. And that's the way you drove. You drove with precision. You drove smooth, you flowed with the car. A Riley and Scott, you're taking a big hammer and just going bang, bang, bang with the thing. And you just attack, 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 attack. Because that's how you drove the car. So two very, very different. And yeah, Jeff, it's kind of a shame because I don't know if we'll ever see that kind of a difference again. I don't know.
Well, I think the thing is the CFD, the simulation, all of our shaker rigs and everything have driven us toward, like I said, the right answer, right? So everybody's going to do that. Back in those days, you had Tony Southgate going, I think it should look like this. It should be shaped like this. And you had Bob Riley as, you know, two brilliant top designers of their time going, I think it should be shaped like this. And I'm going to take this approach. And Tony Southgate said, I'm going to take this approach. And he had Ferrari guys helping him with it and all of that. I think I heard one time, and it might've been Tony himself who described to me, he goes, yeah, I got to design the back of the car, or the front of the car up to the driver's cockpit. And then Ferrari did the whole back half. And we didn't talk about what each other were doing.
Really? And
yeah. I mean, he described that to me because Tony did. So we as in Team Scandia, took these cars to Le Mans, 96, 97, somebody will have to look that up. Anyway, we took these cars to Le Mans, and we knew that the car that we had for IMSA was way too draggy for Le Mans. So we had to come up with a Le Mans kit or whatever. And so we did a bunch of testing at Paul Ricard. We spent a lot of time in Italy at Dallara, and Tony Southgate did his magic and came up with a Le Mans kit, smaller wing, lower wing, new rear engine cover. And people can see the pictures, but it changed the shape of the car quite a bit. And to to do that, it took, you know, it took a lot of time, a lot of effort. But we could do it in those days. You could change the shape of the car and go to Le Mans with it. And so Tony was complaining about that. He goes, I finally get to fix the car the way I wanted it to work. You know, the Italian, I can get the Italian influence off of it now because it's the way I really wanted it to be originally. So, but it was amazing that it worked so well on so many levels.
And Jeff, I want you to talk a little bit. I want you to re-educate me on the engine side of it because, you know, when I went, when I got back into a 333 was the year 2000, I think it was 99 or 2000. And I went to drive for Kevin Doran. And I was driving with Freddie Lernhardt, who owned Lista Cabinets, and Didier Tays, and then Mauro Baldi at Daytona. And so I drove that car that year. And what I remember is that first, in that year 2000, I think it was Daytona 24. I'm doing my second stint. It's Saturday night. It's got to be at least 8 hours into the race. And I come into turn three and it's, you know, typically a second gear corner in that car, but there was like a gaggle of 27 GT cars. And so I've kind of got to work my way around. I'm down into first gear. Blah, 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 and and all of a sudden the engine kind of goes blip and it burps. And the next thing I know, I look in the mirrors and the back of the car is on fire.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh. It's not funny. It's just, this is the most Italian thing, right? Go on. Sorry.
And the 333, that engine had a, I don't know, a habit. There's probably not the right word for it, but it had a habit of every now and then, if you were out of the throttle for too long, fuel would build up in the intake somewhere and it would backfire up through the injectors and catch the airbox on fire. And that's what happened. We had like a lap lead on the field at eight hours into the race. We were going to like just blow everybody away. We're so good. And this thing, you know, I stood at the side of the track and watched this Ferrari burn. And then Kevin went, enough of this.
They're not doing that.
Kevin again. Being Kevin, right. Enough of that. None of that stuff. And he took that Ferrari V12 out and put a Judd V10 in it. And I drove it with a Judd V10 later in the season. So,
well, that engine was, I can see why Kevin did that, but that engine, I mean, it was the, from what I understood, the 1989 Ferrari F1 motor. And there's this guy, I got to bring this guy's name up, Renzo Setti. And if you've seen pictures of him, he looks like you're, no, I shouldn't say typical Italian. He's a heavy kind of set. He looks like he could be in a mafia.
Jeff, to me, he looks like, you know, you see those little photos or images of three Italian men sitting on a chair in a little village,
right,
sipping coffee.
Smoking a cigar or something. Yeah,
he could be one of those guys.
Exactly.
Yeah, when the picture, you guys, Jeff, you sent a picture on the phone the other day and it came through and I looked at it. My first thought was, there is a man who likes to sit. Like he just has that kind of like inertia, like lack of inertia about him. He's just a mass of a human in that weird way that, you know, old Italian men kind of turn into. It's like they compact down like a neutron star.
Yeah. Right.
But, so he was, wait, so who was Renzo?
Renzo. He didn't design the engine. He didn't, but he was kind of, so saying that he was the father of that engine probably isn't right, but he was the caretaker.
Okay.
So the engine got built, designed, and then as a Formula One engine, and then they said, all right, we need somebody to go to the track and make sure that it's warmed up correctly and that it runs correctly and to tune the injection and to change the spark plugs and take care of it. Renzo, you're the guy. So Renzo did that with this engine in Formula One. And then Renzo did whatever he did. And then by whatever, 6-7 years later, they stuffed this thing in the 333 and they went, okay, we need somebody to go to America and take care of the engine. We'll get Renzo because he knows everything about it.
He likes to sit. Why not?
Right.
Sit in America, sit on a plane to America, sit over there.
So they sent Renzo to America. And I think, I'm pretty sure there is no picture of Renzo in the world that doesn't have him with his hand reached into the holding the throttle of a Ferrari engine with the engine cover off, just warming it up, you know, ring, ring, ring. That's Renzo. That's he. I don't think you could start a Ferrari engine without Renzo being there. I mean, he was the guy.
And Renzo was there when they unloaded the car off the truck in Atlanta. And he was the one that fired it up and then reached in there and went rip, rip, like, yeah, yeah. Like there's a certain way of blipping that throttle, I guess.
Yep. And I'll tell you, so we're talking in the mid 90s now, early to mid 90s with Renzo, when you saw him first, Ross, do that. I went to a Ferrari Challenge race. I was running a Ferrari Challenge car at Daytona, must have been 2017, 2018. And it was the world final. So they bring out all the historic Ferraris. They let them run around and stuff like that. And they had a handful of 333s. And I walked over there just because it's a 333. I love that car. I want to see him. And I walk up to this collection of 333s and there's Renzo standing right next to one, warming it up. And I'm like, I walked up, we gave each other a big hug. And it's like, oh, I haven't seen you in 25 years or 30 years, whatever it was. And he was the same guy, revving that motor up, warming it up.
Again, so, that's...
So, oh, Jeff, can I... what I was told, and maybe this was from Kevin Doran, who was trying to justify, let's get rid of this Ferrari motor and stick a Judd motor in this Judd thing. But I was told that there were ways to make that engine more fuel efficient, get better fuel mileage by changing the software or the whatever it was for the injection. So it didn't dump so much fuel in there when you were out of the throttle, which was the thing that every now and then in the wrong RPM and whatever else would
caught it on fire,
catch the car on fire.
Yeah.
But it didn't spit those really cool flames out the back of the exhaust on a downshift, and Ferrari needed those. And, you know, you were sending some photos. I pulled up the one photo I have of me in the car at Road Atlanta. And there's a flame shooting on the back of the car.
Yep. Yep. That's, I mean, and then they made us put mufflers on the thing.
Yeah.
Which
what
was,
did it sound like with mufflers? Bad?
Terrible.
Just quieter?
Terrible. I went to,
yes,
went to Portland. Here's my muffler story. Went to Portland. Team Scandia was based in Seattle. So we tested at Portland. Oh, I remember. Yeah. We were testing at Portland because we raced there, I think. Mm-hmm. And Andy Evans was really good friends, maybe probably still is, with Bill Gates. And Bill was a car guy. He loved cars, but he was like, this is the mid 90s. So he was super into running Microsoft. And so we were going to, Andy was going to have Bill come out and drive the Ferrari, just the 333, just to bomb around in it, you know? And so we were running around practicing. This was the day before Bill was going to get there. We were running around practicing and we had the mufflers on because that was what was required. And somebody, I don't know, said, why don't we, it's just a test. Why don't we take the mufflers off? And I don't think anybody cared. And so we took the mufflers off and the thing sounded amazing. And it shot flames out the back of it again because the mufflers kind of like captured those flames and didn't let them shoot out the back. So it sounded great with flames shooting out the back of it. And it reminded us all of how cool that car was before we got the mufflers and the restrictors and everything else. So when they go to these Ferrari Challenge races, they run them unmuffled and unrestricted. And so they're, if you ever get a chance, go to a Ferrari Challenge race where there's a Ferrari 333 and watch it drive.
And I think it's worth noting too, that, you know, this is a car that sounds like a Formula One car because it sounds exactly like a Formula One car. You know that, Jeff, you're right. That motor, it was the 640 or 641 F1 car. It was 88 or 89. But that,
okay,
you know, going back to the idea that, you know, Ferrari tends to leave certain things alone. They stuck with V12s and F1 for so much longer than it made sense, and so much longer really than, you know, because a V12 is a long motor, changes how the car is built, changes where it carries its weight. And so much of, I mean, I sat in, we were actually at R&T one year. We very nearly did a test with a 640. And they ended up sitting in it and we pushed it around for photography and did some other things, but we ended up not running it. But I got a chance to look at the motor and got a chance to just kind of poke around the car. And so much of that driveline, some of the castings looked straight out of 1965. And they weren't, but just the way they were finished and the way some of the machine surfaces were finished, there were parts of it that were absolutely gorgeous. And then there were parts that didn't particularly matter, where it was clear that they just got churned out. And that's mirrored in the road cars. It's mirrored in so much of the decisions the company made over the years, where it's like there's a basket of things that count and a basket of things that kind of sort of matter and a basket of things that no one will notice, or maybe they might not notice, or maybe even if they notice, they won't care because Ferrari. And yep. it was just this wonderful little wake up to the fact that, you know, you get the impression that for so long that company was just as much in love with its own mystique as you know, they want people to be. And it's just really neat to hear that being in the thing was special and being around it was special.
That engine, the first year we ran it at Daytona, I mean, it was literally, from what I understood, straight out of the Formula One car. And so we go to Daytona, you know, Ross, you said you ran some 2 hour and 40 minute races. You ran one of those with it. And that's kind of what the rest of the year was. We went to Daytona for the first time with it. And suddenly, I don't think it dawned on any of us that this race was longer than 2 hours and 40 minutes. And after about 3 hours, the Scandia car, we had two, I think. But anyway, one of them, yeah, we did have two. One of them, we came in the pits and we normally kept the engine running during a pit stop because it was just a quick 20, 30 second pit stop. The driver came in, got out of the car, and it died. We're like, oh, wow, just quit. Okay, the next driver gets in and he tries to start it and it won't start. Like, wow, okay, that's weird. We could not get this thing started. So we push it behind the wall and we hook a minivan to it.
As one does.
Yeah. Well, first we tried to push it with some mechanics and it still wouldn't start. So then we're like, okay, we got to get it going faster. We hooked a minivan behind it and we pulled it behind you can't do this now, but back then you could pull there was a road basically behind the pit lane. So we pulled it behind the pit lane, got it going to whatever mile an hour, 40 mile an hour, and then bump started it and it started. Like, okay. So we went back out with that car. The next car was about to pit and we realized we can't shut this car off and we can't let the driver out of the car either because it's going to die and we can't restart it. So long story short is my mechanic, Steve McCaughey, comes up with this idea to drill a giant hole in the bodywork with the driver, you know, driver stops, keeps the engine running, rum, 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 keeps it running. He drills a giant hole in the bodywork right above the throttle. He reaches in, picks up the throttle with his hand, like Renzo used to warm it up, but he's got the throttle going. So the minute he grabs, drills the hole, gets his hand in there, driver jumps out, new driver jumps in, new driver picks up the throttle with his foot. Steve can let go of the throttle. And we did the next 18 hours worth of pit stops just like that, because the thing would die. Other teams were having the same problems with the Ferrari. Turns out the valve seats were getting hammered into the aluminum casting of the head. As the valves closed, you know, it hits the seat. Well, the material behind the valve seat wasn't thick enough to support it for more than 3 hours. And it would hammer the seat back in. And now the valve won't close. And now you have no compression. And so it won't start. It would run if you got some revs to it, but it wouldn't start because it could make no compression. And so they went back to work and they built all new heads. To Ferrari's credit, they went, all right, we can fix this. So they cast new heads for all the 333 sports car engines that had thicker material behind the valve seats. And we never had that problem again.
It's amazing because everything I read at that point, they had basically, like, that's why... was it Durant went with the Judd, right? Because they'd basically stopped caring about it. It was all the development we wanted was done. They didn't have any money to pay attention to the motor. Like, it's kind of cool that they went back to it.
And I think that was later on, right? Because I'm talking 94, 95, 96 era, where it was still a thing. But later, I think you can talk about it, Ross, but like when Kevin put the Judd in there, it was like Ferrari didn't really care then anymore.
Was it by the year 2000, I'm not sure if Ferrari even, they didn't keep track of them.
Was the thing essentially reliable apart from that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had some gearbox, ran a Ricci car later must have been 99, 2000, must have been about that same time. And the gearboxes, they had this little drop gear in it, and that would fail sometimes. We failed one of those on the Ricci car at Daytona, and most teams had spare gearbox, spare back halves for the Ferrari for the long races. And the back half was basically you unbolted a few bolts of the gearbox where it bolted to the engine, and it was the whole back half of the car, gearbox, suspension, wing, everything, you know, tires, wheels, the whole thing. And you just unbolted that and bolt plugged a new one on. You could do it in like 20 minutes. And so not like the Audi guys, people have seen the Audi do it in whatever, 4.5 minutes, but it was kind of the precursor to that. And you could change it pretty quick and go back out.
So we're about out of time, but I want to close this out by asking you guys, each of you, one thing, because the stuff we've been orbiting this entire episode has all been kind of a collection of the same ideas and the things that make a race car, which, as Ross mentioned, is a tool, right? It is this cold, theoretically unfeeling thing that the better it does its job, the less it looks less like, the more it looks like a hammer and the less it is a paintbrush. But it is ultimately kind of both, right? So I want to ask you both, how is it important that, and I have my own opinion on this, which no one needs to hear, but is it important that race cars be emotional things, that they hit you emotionally? Or is it just ultimately a hammer? Is it just hammer makes nail go in wood and that's it? Does it have to carry feeling for you?
It doesn't have to. At the end of the day, all that really matters to a racer, I'm pretty sure I'm speaking for Jeff as well, all we really care about is, can I win with this thing? That's all that really matters. Now, you mentioned feeling, and I'm going to say the added benefit of the 333 was you could win and have a good feeling at the same time. I still remember that feeling of driving that car at Road Atlanta that first weekend and just going, the car feels so good. And it was straight out of the box. It hadn't been Jeffized yet.
For anybody who's not watching the video, when Ross said so good, his eyes closed a little and he just had this like, so good. It was his face did a thing, right? Like,
but if you had that same feeling and you couldn't win, I'll take a Riley and Scott.
Yep. I think it's, Ross is exactly right. We all want to, first of all, the car has to win. And I think the Ferrari 333 would be the whole mystique of that car. And the Ferrari 333, IMSA had inducted their first group into their Hall of Fame last year. And the 333 was inducted in year one of the IMSA Hall of Fame. I mean, think about that.
A car.
That's the Ferrari. But if it would have never won a race and been a disaster, and Ross would say, man, it was terrible to drive, I couldn't stand it, and engineers and mechanics were like, the thing broke down all the time, but it was a Ferrari, and I think people would care a lot less about it.
That's a pretty great collection of answers. I lied. I fibbed. I am going to tell you guys what I think. I'm split. There's a large voice in me, large voice in my head that says, well, there are a lot of voices in my head, but there's a large voice in my head that says it's a tool and who cares and win and go. And any club race car I've ever been in that hasn't worked, that's all I hear. And then there's another equally large voice in my head that just wants the romance and the owls and the candles and all of it. And it's so funny because it means so many different things to so many different people. And yet it's ultimately all the same stuff. But
well, and that's the thing. So it means so much to so many different people. There's drivers who are linked to that car strongly. Fermin Velez, really great friend of mine. He's, you know, when people, he's done more than drive Ferrari 333s, but he's linked to that car. People know him for that car. He made his mark in racing on that car. The Momo car. People don't go, oh, it was a Ferrari 333. They go, yeah, the Momo car. Well, that's a 333. There's been other cars with Momo on it, but nobody really thinks of that as the Momo car. It's a 333. It's done a lot for a lot of people, me included. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do the things in racing that I got to do post 333 without that car and the people involved giving me that opportunity to play with such a good car.
That's really cool. Well, with that, we are out of time. That's our show. Tune in next week when our topic will be Ross and Jeff talking about that time in high school where they skipped school for the day and they stole Jeff's dad's Ferrari and went to an art museum with Ross's wife because Ross was the sausage king of Chicago and Don Kishane, and that's how the movie ended. But we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Ciao.
Have fun.